Hare Krishna. So thank all of you for coming today afternoon for this Sunday program. I'll be speaking on the... Am I comfortably audible behind or it is low?
Yes.
It's okay. So I'll be speaking on the topic of Krishna and his manifestation as the holy name. Especially the topic was, you know, the holy name is everything. There's a beautiful song by a Vaishnava Acharya called Kevalashtakam. And this verse talk, it concludes with the chorus, the song Harer Nama Eva Kevalam. A holy name is everything. Harer Nama Eva Kevalam. So one of the verses is Abrahma Stamba Paryantam Sarva Maya Mayam Idam Maya Mayam Jagat Satyam Satyam Puna Satyam Harir Nameva Kevalam. So it says Abrahma. Brahma is in the Vedic hierarchy the most powerful being within this world. Stamba is just a blade of grass. Actually, it is just a stump of a tree or a blade of grass, very small. So, the verse says that from the most influential being in the world, in the universe, down to an insignificant blade of grass, Sarva Maya Mayam Jagat, all of it is filled with Maya. And then, if it's all filled with Maya, then what is the reality? Satyam, Satyam, Puna, Satyam. There is a repetition three times and there is also a grammatical emphasis through Punaha again. So four times the sense is said. The reality is Hare Nameva Kevalam. The holy name of Krishna is the reality. Now the word Maya is actually a very common word for those who know the Vedic literature. At the same time,
is that machine speaking for all of you?
Okay, so the word Maya is often translated as illusion. Actually, yes, Maya is illusion. But there are different kinds of illusions. Say for example, if we see a mirage in a desert. Now, we see the mirage. But if I go there is no water over there. This is one kind of illusion. This is illusion in perception. That means I see something which actually doesn't exist. That is illusion in perception. That can be called Maya. But the Bhagavatam defines Maya in a deeper way. In the Chaturshloki Bhagavatam, in the four verses that are considered the essence of the Bhagavatam, there Maya is explained to be the vision of seeing anything meaningful and separate from Krishna. Rite artham yat pratiyeta na pratiyet chatmani tam vidyadatmano maya yatha bhaso yatha tamaha. So if we see anything as attractive, but we don't see its connection with Krishna, then that is considered to be Maya. So that means, here when it is saying that, the verse is stating that, okay, Brahma, everyone down from Brahma to blade of grass, it's all Maya. What does it mean? It's not saying that Brahma doesn't exist or the blade of grass doesn't exist. They exist. So it is not talking about illusion in perception. It is talking about illusion in conception. The conception is that somebody, say, he's the head of that person is the head of the state of a country. They're considered very big and powerful. You know, the head of the president of the United States. They have command over all the defense forces. They have command over the finances. They're very powerful. As an ordinary citizen, we may say, how much influence do we have? So this difference is there. So what the Bhagavatam, what this verse is stating is, when it is saying that it's all Maya, that means the difference is a reality. But the illusion is to think that that this difference will make any lasting difference. The difference between poor and wealthy, the difference between good looking and not so good looking, the difference between intelligent and not so intelligent, all these differences are real. But in the long run, these don't make much difference because they are all temporary. What makes a real difference is not what we have, but what we do with what we have. I may have little wealth, but if I use it well, then I can actually, if we use whatever wealth we have in proper dharmic way, use it to serve Krishna, then we become spiritually elevated. Somebody can have a lot of wealth and they misuse it and they get karmically implicated. So the illusion is that the world itself can give us pleasure separate from Krishna. So sarva maya mayam jagat. That means the world offers us promise. You do this, you'll be happy. You do get this, you'll be happy. Achieve this, you'll be happy. This is an illusion. The reality is that it is Krishna alone and our connection with Krishna that can provide us happiness. So the holy name is our most accessible connection with Krishna. Krishna has many, many manifestations. His deities is a manifestation. The scriptures are a manifestation. The holy places are manifestation. The dham is a manifestation. Among all these manifestations, the holy name is his most accessible manifestation. The holy name is a portable form of God. We can carry him anywhere with us. And the bead bag also needs some pocket or a bag. But the holy name itself, we can carry on our tongue also. We can come to the temple and take darshan. And we feel sanctified by the presence of Krishna. But the holy name, we can take wherever we are. Now, in that sense, the holy name is the most accessible manifestation of Krishna for us. Now, sometimes we see chanting as an activity isolated from the rest of our life. Sometimes some devotees say, Prabhupada said that 99% of your spiritual advancement depends on chanting. That's true, he said it once. But the important point is, chanting is not just an activity in isolation from the rest of our life. The purpose of bhakti is to develop a loving relationship with Krishna. And that loving relationship is what satisfies the heart. The experience of reciprocal love in that relationship is what comprises spiritual advancement. And chanting offers us the means to do that. So, we cannot reduce the whole of bhakti and the whole of life simply to chanting. But at the same time, we cannot neglect chanting thinking that other things are all important. Both have to be in balance. And if we understand this point, that actually we are developing a relationship with Krishna. And when we are trying to develop a relationship with Krishna, the way in which we can connect with Krishna very accessibly is the holy name. If we see the Shikshashtakam is a series of 8 verses that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has sung. He's recited them, and those we recite in the morning in the temple every day. Now this verse, this Shikshashtakam starts with the glory of the holy name. Cheto darpanam arjanam bhamaha davavi nirvapanam shreya kairava chandrika vitaranam vidyavadu jeevanam Anandam Budhivardhanam Pratipadam Puranam Pratasvadanam Sarvatma Stapadam Param Vijayate Shri Krishna Sankirtanam. So it starts with the glory of the holy. The next verse also talks about how the Krishna is so accessible. Without any rules and regulations, we can chant the holy names. And seamlessly, as the verses move on, the last verse is a focus on Krishna. That, oh Krishna, whether you accept me or reject me, whether you embrace me or make me broken hearted by leaving me, by trampling me, you are my Lord, no matter what happens. This is a direct prayer to Krishna as a person. So what has happened when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has sung the Shikshashtakam is, in a seamless way, the non-difference of the holy name and Krishna are revealed. So he starts with meditating on the holy name and he ends with meditating on Krishna. So if some people think that chanting simply means muttering some mantra, uttering some sound with our tongue, then we are having a very oversimplified understanding of the process of chanting. Yes, it involves uttering some mantras. But what is the purpose? The purpose is to spiritualize our consciousness, to make us develop a relationship with Krishna. And so when we start chanting the holy names, there are many things in the world which distract us. And when we understand that it is Krishna who is the ultimate reality, then we don't give those distractions so much attention. Distraction is inevitable because it is the very nature of the mind to get distracted. So the mind may wander, but we don't have to wander with it. What that means is the mind is like a child. And as a child, children are going to be by nature restless. You know, if a parent tells a child, sit here peacefully. Well, the child may sit peacefully for some time, but the child may slip away at any time. So a watchful mother will keep an eye out. You know, what is my child doing? That's natural. So similarly, when we are talking about the mind, chanchala, Krishna uses the word chanchala to describe the mind frequently. So the mind is going to be restless. So when the mind becomes restless, it wanders from here and there. And usually where does it wander? It wanders towards those things which it thinks will give pleasure. Or it wanders towards those things which it thinks are going to be problems which are going to soon come. There are two main modes of distraction. If I am going along this road, then if I am just idling along the road, I might look around. You know, is there some like, good hotel over here? Is there some nice garden? Maybe I can eat something. Maybe I can see something. Is there some movie theater? I can go and watch a movie. So we are looking around to see if there is something enjoyable around. That way, while going along the road, if you find something enjoyable, you may get distracted. Or if we sense there is some danger, maybe there are some riots going on, or maybe some terrorists are there looking around. Then if I feel there is some danger, I might just slip off. So basically, like that, the mind, it gets distracted by pleasure and it gets distracted by trouble. So when it gets distracted by pleasure, it feels that, okay, this chanting that I'm doing, it's not all that enjoyable. It's not all that enjoyable. Actually, it's a austerity. And let me do something enjoyable. And then you start thinking something else to do. That's how it gets distracted. The other is that if you are having some problems in our life, I mean, maybe this, oh, I have to deal with this issue, this person said like that, I have to get this done. Then all those thoughts come and you think, how will I do this? How will I do that? And the mind gets distracted. So basically, the pleasures that we can have or the problems we need to solve, the mind gets distracted by these two things, primarily. So in our process of improving our chanting, we can say that there are three levels, broadly speaking. Now, we first become conscious of our consciousness. Then we become conscious of our distractions. And then we become conscious of Krishna. What does that mean? First we become conscious of our consciousness. So imagine somebody is watching TV and say some very enjoyable TV program, some cricket match or some movie is going on. And while they're watching the TV, some thief comes in. And a thief comes in, sneaks in, thief wants to steal the TV. And a thief comes and picks up the TV and starts taking the TV away. Now this person is so caught in watching the TV that instead of stopping the thief, this person goes along with the thief and keeps watching the TV. Keeps watching the TV. So, you could say our mind is like the TV. Something is being broadcast on the mind. And then we are watching it. And we are watching it and then suddenly, the mind is usually not single track. The mind has multiple tracks on it and different tracks become active at different times. So right now, say we are sitting and discussing about the glories of the Holy Spirit. I am speaking, you are hearing. And then while this is going on, there are multiple tracks that are going on in the mind also. Now maybe we are thinking, okay, what is the prasadam today? Or we were thinking, oh, I have got Hare Krishna. So I have to I have to get this work done after the program. How? When will this get over? When will I reach back? There are so many thoughts going on. Now, these thoughts, Hare Krishna. Should I just avoid the mic? Am I audible behind? Maybe we can just avoid the mic. Hare Krishna. Okay. So, the mind has, say, one track is broadcasting something. So, one important thing is that we need the mind. See, the mind is the link between us and the world. The soul is spiritual. The mind is, the world around us is material. The mind is the channel between the soul and the world. So, we need the mind. For functioning in this world, the mind is indispensable for us. So, we need the mind, but the mind has multiple channels and it gets distracted. So, for example, say I'm watching, so the mind is like a TV on which a particular program is going on and I'm watching it. So, by program, it's not as nothing negative. Say right now, so the mind is a screen on which, say, you are seeing me, you are hearing my voice, I am seeing all of you. So, this is, all of us have the mind, which is acting like a screen. But within the mind, there are multiple forces. Something else comes up and then some other thought comes along. So it's like, suppose, you know, we are watching a program and somebody else has the control of the remote. And they suddenly change the program. And then, hey, this was going on. What happened now? How did it change suddenly? So like that, you know, we are thinking of something, doing something, and suddenly, how did my mind go there? Sometimes if we are trying to focus on something, and then we start wondering. You know, we are trying to study or we are trying to hear something. And it's like, at one moment, the book is there in front of us, we are studying. At another moment, you know, we are on some cricket stadium somewhere. It's something else has been broadcast over there. So it's like, you know, we are watching the TV and we need to watch the TV, whatever we want to see, it's available on the TV only. But it's like somebody else has the remote. So if somebody else has the remote, they can change the program at any time. And if we are not careful, we are watching one program and next moment we end up watching another program. That's how we become distracted. So, like that, the screen is there, but what is broadcast on the screen, that changes very fast. So, the first thing is, we become conscious of our consciousness. Conscious of our consciousness means, okay, we become aware of what I am thinking. Okay, I have, for example, okay, I am right now in the temple and I have come here to learn about Krishna. Or whatever it is that we are doing, we become conscious of our consciousness. This is called as mindfulness or self-awareness. Krishna describes this in the Bhagavad Gita as a characteristic of the mode of goodness. In 14.11, he says, Sarvadvareshu dehesmin prakasham upajayate jnanam yadatada vidyar vivruddham sattvam ityuta. So, Sarvadvareshu dehesmin, deha is the body, dvara is the gates. So, for all the gates of the body, the gates refer to the eyes, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the skin. From all these, input from the outer world come inside. So, sarvadvareshu dehesmin prakasham upajayate. When there is illumination, when there is light, when all the doors to the senses are lit. Now, what does it mean? Is it like some people in goodness, their eyes have some light coming out of it, their ears have some light coming out of it? No, it's not like that. What Krishna is saying is, prakasham upajayate. What kind of prakash? Jnanam. The light of knowledge is there. And at that time, vidyad vivruddham sattvam ityuta. This is in the mode of goodness. So what this means is that if there is a door and the door, there is no light at the door. It's dark. If it's dark at the door, then I don't know who is coming in, who is going out. Now a friend may come in, an enemy may come in. I will be completely in the dark of who is coming and who is going. But if there is a light at the door, then we are aware, okay, what is coming in? You know, if we see, oh, somebody who is a suspicious looking person coming in, we'll go and close the door. Let them come inside. If a friend is coming, we'll open the door. Please come, welcome. So, similarly, through our senses and through our past memories, now there are various thoughts that are entering into our consciousness. Now, if we are not conscious of our consciousness, it's like, we are not aware of who is coming in through the door. So anybody and everybody comes in. So when we are practicing bhakti, to focus on Krishna constantly, to focus on the sound of the holy name of Krishna constantly, that is ideal. To the extent we focus on Krishna's holy name,
to the extent we become purified, to that extent we become satisfied. I'll come to that later. But initially, what we need is to be conscious of our consciousness. So, okay, now I'm sitting down to chant. Why am I chanting? Because it connects with me with Krishna. Because it purifies me. Because that is the Yuga Dharma. Because that is what my spiritual master has told. You can have many reasons, whatever it is. But becoming aware, becoming conscious of our consciousness. Nowadays, obesity is a big concern for many people. And according to some surveys, you know, people all over the world, especially in the first world, they spend something like 40 times more money on losing weight than is what is required for feeding all the hungry people in the world. So, it's a big concern. Now, what happens is nobody goes out thinking that I want to become fat. Maybe people who are very thin, they may want to eat to gain weight. But nobody goes out thinking that I want to eat and become fat. But most often is that people are not conscious of their consciousness when they are eating. When we start eating, at that time, there's some taste which comes, but we're not really conscious of the fact that I'm eating. There's a survey done in which people were asked, how many food-related decisions do you do every day? And they said around 10-15. That was the average answer. But actually, when they went over the whole day, found that on an average, people made more than 200 food-related decisions every day. Now, how 200? Because every time we see an item, we may see a billboard, we may see an ad, we may see somebody else eating something. At that time, we can decide, should I eat this, should I not eat this? And even when we are eating, okay, should I take a second helping of this or should I take a second helping of that? We are making so many decisions, and if we are not conscious of our consciousness, then those decisions are made for us. Those decisions are made for us. And what makes those decisions? That is the pattern of habits that we have from the past. So the process of chanting, sometimes we may feel that, okay, I thought chanting involves, you know, I'll get peace, I'll get joy. But then my mind is getting so distracted. What is the use of chanting if mind is getting distracted? But actually, just to become aware of how distracted the mind is, that is also progress over getting distracted with the mind. First level is that whatever, you know, I'm watching the TV and suddenly somebody changes the program, I start watching the change program. And I just spend my time like that without realizing what is happening. The second thing is, I'm watching a program, suddenly the program changes. I say, what is going on? Don't change it like that. I start come back to the original program, start watching it. Again, the program changes. I may get exasperated. Oh, so many times the program is changing. But at least I'm aware that it is changing. Isn't it? Initially, we are not even aware of it. So in that sense, becoming conscious of our consciousness is also a step towards spiritual advancement, towards spiritual growth. We become conscious of our consciousness. Okay, what am I thinking about? That's the first step. We can be conscious of Krishna also at times. When there is beautiful kirtan, there is a beautiful darshan, or there is sweet darshan, where there is sweet kirtan, or there is an absorbing class, we may get absorbed in Krishna at those times. But when we want to focus and concentrate on Krishna, at that time it's not easy to do that consistently. But if we focus, if we try to focus and then we realize how distracted I am, that is that awareness of how distracted I am, that is also a step forward. We are becoming more self-aware. So we become conscious of our consciousness. And then, after we become conscious of our consciousness, then the next step is we become conscious of our distractions. Conscious of our distractions means not that we think about those distractions when we are supposed to be doing something else, but rather, if we become conscious of what kind of thoughts trouble me, and we plan to deal with them. So for example, if I find that, whenever I sit down to chant, maybe my pending housework, those thoughts come to me. Or my financial instability, those thoughts come to me. So we have, although the mind can have unlimited distractions, but there are certain standard distractions which keep troubling us. And sometimes some occasionally new distractions also come. So our distractions actually can reveal to us what are our prominent attachments, what are our prominent conditionings, and then we can plan how to deal with them. So for example, if I find that a lot of financial instability, financial worries trouble me whenever I'm chanting, then then we can decide that we use our intelligence to decide how to deal with this. Okay, if I worry, I may lose my job, or my savings will run out, or how will I pay the mortgage, whatever are the worries. So, worry is the, worrying is like, okay, I'll just hold this. So worrying is like, worrying is like paying an interest on a loan that we have not taken. Worrying is like paying an interest on a loan that we have not taken. That means there are some problems which are present right now. But usually what happens is the mind imagines future complications that might come from that problem. So the problem is, say, like a 10 kg weight. But when we worry about it, we are adding 30 kg more. Okay, this may go wrong, that may go wrong, that may go wrong. And when we do that, now 10 kg weight carrying is difficult, but it's manageable. But if I have to carry a 40 kg weight, it's much more difficult. So, like that, when we start worrying too much, okay, this may go wrong, that may go wrong, that may go wrong, that may go wrong. And then we become crippled by that. So it's the problem has not yet come. The problem has not yet come. Okay, there is a present problem, but we are worrying about the future complications that may come because of that problem. And in that sense, it's like a loan we are not yet taken. But we are already paying the interest on that. So, now how do we deal with worries? There are different practical ways. One is, if you look back at our own life, we can see that most of our worries don't materialize. Almost more than 90% of our worries, I think this may go wrong, that may go wrong, that may go wrong, that may go wrong. And many of those things don't happen. So there are, now in one sense, when it comes to things going wrong, anything can go wrong. If I'm going to be fearful, sometimes I think if I'm driving on the road and some drunken driver comes and hits me and I die, what is going to happen? Now there is possibility and there is probability. The two are different. If we start worrying about possibilities, there is a possibility that while sitting here, the roof may cave in and we will die right now. Isn't it? If we start worrying about possibilities, we will not be able to do anything. What to speak of driving on the road, we will not be able to sit anywhere else. So, possibilities, we cannot just let ourselves get carried away. But there are probabilities. Probability means, okay, this can happen. If I am driving a vehicle in which the fuel is running out, then that my vehicle will stop at some time. That is not a possibility. That is something, is an eventuality. It's going to happen. So we need to, when our fears start coming us, when we start worrying about situations, if there are certain habitual things which trouble us, it's good to take some time out consciously. And after taking that time out consciously, we plan. Okay, this fear, if it comes, okay, I'll deal with it like this. This comes up, I can do this. And this, it's unlikely. If it comes up, I'll deal with it. So we have to use our intelligence to address our fears. So when we don't address our fears, we don't address our worries, using our intelligence, then those worries run on a rampage during our chanting. And then actually, see, Maya is very cunning. She not only distracts us from the holy name, but she sometimes can make us feel guilty. Hey, you are having so many responsible things. How can you just sit and chant? Do something practical. Isn't it? Yeah, actually speaking, yes. We have to do something practical, no doubt. But there's a time for everything. So it is not that. See, the same mind, which I have seen it many times. For me, the problems are slightly different. I am a writer. So I get many ideas for writing just while I'm chanting. And then I feel, this idea, it's going to be such a brilliant article. How can I miss it? And I feel so excited. I have to write this right away. But then, actually, in the daytime when I get the same idea, okay, you know, I've written so many articles. This also I'll write sometime. What is there to get so excited about? So actually, the energy is not for that particular thing. The energy is just to distract us from chanting. So, yes, there's a good idea. I may be able to use it later. But it is not necessary that that idea has to be acted on right now. Similarly, there are problems and they have to be dealt with. But it is not necessary that they have to be dealt with right now. So, if we find out there are certain patterns of worries that trouble us, then we address them with our intelligence. And if we find that, see, the best, we could say at one level, the best chanting is when we just pick up our beads and complete all our rounds without distraction. Whatever japa we are doing. But often, that is quite difficult. Our mind chants for some time and then it gets distracted. And if we find that there is too much distraction because of one train of thoughts, because I'm worrying about something, then if it's a regular pattern of worry that troubles us, then we prepare ourselves by addressing it. You know, maybe write down things. Okay, if I have financial worries, what will I do? You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These are the ways. This is what I have done to deal with this. This is what I'm going to deal with the future. And in this way, we use the intelligence to calm the mind down. We use the intelligence to calm the mind down. So if we find one thought is distracting us too much, then after completing a round, we just put it aside. Because sometimes if the mind is distracted, trying to keep chanting, it is just, we just don't connect with Krishna at all. And the chanting itself feels like a burden. When will this get over with? So our purpose is not just to get the rounds done. Our purpose is to connect with Krishna. So if we are finding ourselves too distracted, then we put aside the chanting for a few minutes and read our own organized thoughts. Okay, this is the worry and this is what I have done to deal with it. So now, it is not that every time a small worry comes up, we do this. Because the mind will use this also as an excuse for becoming distracted from chanting. But if you are finding repeatedly, there is a repeated strong distraction, I am not able to focus, then we can just go over that. That will help us calm down. Yeah, I have done these things to deal with it and this is what I will do in future and things will work out. So, actually speaking, just like a coin has heads and tails. So, one side of the coin is worry, the other side of the coin is intensity. Anxiety and intensity are two sides of the same coin. Now, in our life, whatever we do, there are certain things which are in our control. And there are many things which are not in our control. So when we focus on that which is not in our control, that is when we get anxiety. On the other hand, when we focus on that which is in our control, we get intensity. So it's the same situation. Say for example, a student has to study for the exam. Say tomorrow is the exam. That time the student may think, oh, tomorrow is the exam, I don't know what question will come, how will I remember? Will I remember the answers at that time? What if I make a silly mistake? What if this goes, what if the computer makes a mistake? What if the examiner is in a bad mood? I can think of so many things. Now all these things are not in my control. If I think about those things, I'll get paralyzed with anxiety. But on the other hand, if I focus on that which is in my control, what is in my control? Okay, let me study now. Okay, I've studied these subjects, let me revise, let me memorize. And then if you know the exam is going to come tomorrow and this is my last chance to study, then actually we can develop intensity. So we often think of things as things are in control or things are out of control. But bhakti brings in a higher dynamic to this duality. Things may not be in control, but that does not mean that they are out of control. How is that? Things may not be in my control, but things are still in Krishna's control. So, things are still in Krishna's control. And that's why, when we start feeling very worried about things, if we focus, okay, those things, those problems, if they come up, I'll think about how to deal with them. But whether those problems are going to come or not, I don't know right now. That is not in my control. It is in Krishna's control. So, let me focus on Krishna's holy name right now. And Krishna will either take care of the things himself or will give me the intelligence to take care of those things. So like that, the same thing which causes anxiety can also bring intensity. The same stimulus, the same uncertainty, the same problem. If we dwell on the problem, that will cause us anxiety. But if we think that, yes, this problem is there, but Krishna is bigger than this problem, and Krishna will help me deal with this, then we will focus on connecting with Krishna more. And thus the same problem can bring intensity to our meditation. This is how we can deal with our anxieties when they distract us. So I said that these three stages. First is we become conscious of our consciousness. At least we are conscious. Okay, what is the program going on the TV of my mind right now? Is it the program I want, or has somebody changed the channel and showing something else entirely? Then I find out, okay, what are the kind of programs that come repeatedly over here? Now, what are the kind of distractions by which I am troubled repeatedly? And we try to deal with those distractions. So one set of distractions is anxieties. The other set of distractions is pleasures. We all have our own attachments, and those attachments they very strongly drag our consciousness away. So basically, our attachments are nothing but our unexamined definitions of happiness. We all have a certain definition of happiness. So for example, for an alcoholic, pleasure lies at the bottom of a bottle of alcohol. The more I drink, the more pleasure I get. Now this is their definition of happiness. Now we all have certain definitions of happiness, and most often in materialistic life, we never examine our definitions of happiness. What does examining our definitions of happiness mean? Are you able to hear, or are you finding it difficult? Okay. So what does examining our definitions of happiness mean? It means, you know, I have a certain presumption that this will make me happy, or doing this comprises happiness. But does it really make me happy? Does it really make me happy? So, you know, many times when people say, oh, okay, I want to enjoy life, so I'll on a hard day's work, I'll come back and watch TV. I think, oh, watching TV is enjoyment. Now, yes, watching TV might provide some recreation, some relaxation. But quite often for people, when they're watching TV, you know, they're most excited when they are changing channels than watching programs. Because once you start watching a program, some parts may be exciting, some parts may be boring, some parts may be disgusting. So, but then when you're changing channels, okay, maybe something will be good here, something will be good here, something will be good here, something will be good here. But sometimes we find, you know, go through 100 channels and there's nothing interesting going on anywhere. So basically, we all need to examine our definitions of happiness. There are certain things which may have given us pleasure earlier, but as we keep practicing bhakti, we get a higher taste. And when we get the higher taste, that higher taste actually makes worldly pleasures far less appealing. We may do those same activities again and again, but we don't get much pleasure to those activities. And we do them not because they are enjoyable, but just because they have become habits. Just because they have become habits. Many times when some children are born in devotee families, and when they grow up, they come to teenage years, there is some rebelliousness that comes up naturally because of teenage. And they want to explore the world. And then if parents tell them, don't do this, don't do this, then their rebelliousness increases all the more. I want to explore this. So there was one devotee in Pune. He was born in a very wonderful devotee family. Both parents were devotees. His elder sister was also a devotee. When he came to his teenage years, he experienced this teenage rebellion. He started exploring various things. And one day he went to a music concert, and this was about 15 years ago. So at that time, you know, rock music concerts were not very common in India. His friends were, oh, this is so enjoyable, I just want to go there and enjoy. And he's excited, he went there and he was waiting. And finally, when the rock music started and the whole thing was going on, at a certain point, suddenly it struck me, this is just noise. Even a simple kirtan in temples is much sweeter. So, it is not that he had done any praying before that. It is not that he was not at all being spiritual at that time. But just that epiphany came to him. Come on, you know, my friends are saying this is enjoyable. But this is not enjoyable. This is just noise. It's just noise. So, what happened was that in a forceful way, at that particular point, he realized that his definition of happiness was wrong. I was thinking that going to a music concert and enjoying rock music is enjoyable. I'm making a statement about rock music per se over here. I'm making a statement about examining our definition of happiness. So, our mind gets excited about many things. Say, I'm chanting and I think, you know, what is the latest news update? You know, maybe has India attacked Pakistan? Is a war going to come? So, our mind gets excited about so many things. But if we, okay, I have to get this news update, I have to read this feed, I have to watch this program, I have to do this, I have to do that. The mind gets excited about so many things. But actually, if we subject those things to critical examination, we'll find that, you know, it's not so enjoyable. It's not such a big deal. The mind may get excited about food. The mind may get excited about sensuality. But actually, when we indulge in those things, there's a little pleasure, but after that, it's over. So it's really not worth getting excited about. So if we find that certain temptations distract us during chanting, then at that time, we can subject those temptations to critical examination. Okay, this thing, you know, I think I just have to watch this TV. I just have to visit my Facebook page and see what's the update or whatever. Okay, I have done it so many times in the past. What's the big deal? So if we subject it to examination, that means we will be able to recognize that the mind is getting excited about things that are not really all that exciting. And again, if we use our conscious intelligence to address this. So for example, if I think that, if I'm chanting and I think, I'm hungry, I want to eat this food, I want to eat that food, I want to go there. Whatever is our temptation, if we look at our own experiences, we look at Shastra, we look at what we have heard in class, and we try to deflate the mind's imagination. The mind imagines, if you just get this, you'll enjoy so much. But if we use our intelligence, we use scriptural knowledge to deflate the mind's imagination, then that distraction will not be so much. So here, we are talking about looking at our distractions and not letting them distract us. So pleasure, we all have certain pet conceptions of what is enjoyable. And we need to examine them. Now, it is not possible to give up all our attachments immediately. We're not talking about that. We're just talking about right now whether those attachments or those conceptions of whatever needs to be done, whether it is really that urgent that I have to give up my chanting and go and do that. And yes, I may have to read the news. I may have to do this. I may have to do that. I have to eat food. I have to do so many things in life. But the point is, there's no need for me to get so excited about things. Sometimes in small children, they get excited too much about some small things. Then the parent, they have to cool them down. You know, the child sees a toy and says, I want the toy. Yes, we'll give it to you, but not now. The parents also get excited. Oh, you want the toy? Let's go to the shop right away. Then the more the parents, they pamper the child, the more the child will become demanding. Isn't it? So like that, the mind is like a child. And if we pamper it, as soon as it gets distracted, if we give it to the distraction, then the mind's distractedness will increase more and more. But if we refuse to pander to it, even if we are not able to focus on Krishna at that time, just the effort to restrain it will be helpful. We are actually training our mind. So this is the second level. That is, becoming conscious of our distractions. And third is, becoming conscious of Krishna. So we become conscious of our consciousness, we become conscious of our distractions, and we become conscious of Krishna. Becoming conscious of Krishna means, again, I'll talk about this at three levels. First is using our intelligence. That means when we are chanting the holy names, at that time we may not feel this holy name is very relishable. okay, this is something which I have to do. But with our intelligence, we can understand its importance. Jiva Goswami is one of the most prominent acharyas in our sampradaya. And he writes in his Sandarbhas that for the devotees who are siddhas, for those who are advanced devotees, pure devotees, it is their preeti that keeps them in bhakti. Because they love Krishna, because they have affection for Krishna, they actually engage in devotional activities. But he says for the sadhakas, it is their buddhi that keeps them in bhakti. For the sadhakas, we don't have preeti right now. We don't have affection for Krishna so much. At least I don't have. But buddhi, it is our intelligence which will keep us in bhakti. So, when we want to focus on the holy name, when we are chanting, we need to have an alert intelligence. So, I'll give you a metaphor, again using the parent-child example. Say, a child is sick, a small girl is sick, and her mother takes her to a doctor. He goes to the doctor will maybe smile at the small girl, maybe give her some sweet, maybe pat her. But she will talk seriously with the mother. Okay, this is the disease, and these are the possible complications, but these are medicines you take this morning, afternoon, evening. And the doctor is not going to be always there with the baby or with the mother. The mother has to understand what the doctor is saying, and then the mother has to make sure that the baby takes the medicine. The girl takes the medicine. So, in this case, the doctor is like the spiritual master. That's like our spiritual guides. The mother is like the intelligence. The child is like the mind. And the holy name or remembrance of Krishna in general, that is the medicine. So, it is when the spiritual master speaks to us, when the spiritual master, the senior devotees who are speaking, they may smile at us, talk nicely with us, and they may be very cordial and friendly. All that is good. But when we come to bhakti, when we come to a temple, it's not just a social club where we feel good. That's nice if you feel good. But the point is more. I'm not just going to a doctor to get a smile from the doctor. Isn't it? I'm going to the doctor to get treated, to get some medicine for treating myself. So similarly, when we come in the association of devotees, it is important for us to be cordial, to be friendly. Otherwise, the, say, a small child, if the doctor is very stern looking, the girl may get very frightened. So we should have a cordial atmosphere in the devotee community. But that is not the purpose primarily. The purpose is that there is spiritual knowledge that is given. And then we learn that and using our intelligence. And then just as when the mother comes back home and the mother tells the child, tells the daughter, take the medicine. No, I don't want to take. The mother thinks of it, giving the medicine is a ritual. So she takes a bottle of medicine out from the spoon out of the bottle, puts the spoon in front of the baby's mouth, girl's mouth, and moves it. Baby is just moving her head. You know, and the medicine is all going all over the face. It's getting all over. And after a week, she goes back. She says, did you give the medicine to the doctor? Yes, thrice a day, every day. Well, giving the medicine is not just pouring it out of the spoon. Giving the medicine is ensuring that the medicine goes inside the stomach. So similarly, now when we start practicing bhakti, when we chant the holy names, at that time, the holy name may be uttered with the tongue. And it's important to utter it with the tongue. But the medicine is primarily to be given to the mind. Kulashekar Maharaj, in a very beautiful verse, compares the holy name to medicine. Vyamoha prashama aushadham munimano vritti pravritti aushadham daitendriyartikara aushadham tribhuvane sanjeevanai kaushadham bhaktatyanta hita aushadham bhavabhaya pradvansane kaushadham shreya praptikara aushadham pibamana shri krishna divya aushadham. So he actually gives seven metaphors to compare how the holy name is a medicine. That itself is a whole class. I won't go into that. But the important point here is Piba Mana Shri Krishna Devya Aushadham. The holy name of Krishna is a medicine which is to be drunk by the mind. It is not just to be drunk with the tongue or with the ears. Both are involved. But the point is the mind has to be involved. So, if I am just uttering the holy name with my tongue, but my mind is not in it, then it's like the mother is giving the medicine, but the child is not taking the medicine. Then there is not much benefit. That's why there has to be concentration. And now it's possible that we may not be able to concentrate. But at least there has to be an effort for concentration. If the child is very restless and moving her head rapidly, then the mother, if at least tries to put the medicine in the mouth, some drops will go in. So like that, when we are chanting, the mind will wander here and there. But if we are at least striving to be attentive, then some contact of the holy name will happen with our mind. And whatever medicine goes in, that will heal. So like that, even as if we are chanting 16 rounds, out of that even one or two rounds, if they are attentive, that itself has enormous benefits. The more we are attentive, the better it is. But at least there has to be an effort for being attentive. So this we are talking about, focusing on Krishna using our intelligence. So we use our intelligence to recognize that the holy name is what is going to purify me, it is what is going to elevate me, it is what is going to heal me. And therefore, I must focus on the holy name. And that's why it's good to, when we are chanting, we spend 1.5-2 hours, if we are seriously practicing bhakti, chant 16 rounds, we spend 1.5-2 hours regularly to chant. It's good to invest a little time to hear or read about the glories of the holy name. Even if you spend a few minutes, 4 minutes, 2-3 minutes, 5 minutes, then that will give us some intellectual impetus to focus. Otherwise, we will not be able to focus much. The mind, the tongue will be uttering, but the mind will be going everywhere else. So now, this is one level. I'll talk about three levels at which we can focus on Krishna. First is, using our intelligence. At this stage, we may not have much taste for the holy name. But using our intelligence, knowing that it is going to purify me, we focus on the holy name. Second is, that there is a point of concentration and there is a circle of concentration. That means that it is best if while chanting, we can focus on the sound of Krishna's holy name. And from that, Krishna will be revealed from within. But if that doesn't happen or that is too difficult, what we can do is have a circle of concentration around that point. That means that have some other manifestation of Krishna with which we can connect easily. So for example, we may have a picture of our favorite deities. We may have the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra written down in front of us. Or we may have, if we are initiated, we may have a picture of our initiation, our spiritual master giving us the holy, giving us the beads. Or whatever it is that can inspire us to focus on Krishna. So, if the mind doesn't stay focused on the sound of the holy name, it is going somewhere else. But let it not go all over the universe. When the mind says, I cannot, focusing on the holy name is too difficult, I can't do it. Okay, if you can't do it, it's not necessary that we have to let it go anywhere and everywhere. It's okay, just like if a child says, mother says to the child, sit here. Mother says to the child, no, I can always sit here for so long, I can't sit here. So then that doesn't mean that the mother allowed the child to go anywhere and everywhere in the world. Say, okay, there's a courtyard out there, the gate is locked, you can play in that courtyard. So give it little freedom, give the child a little freedom, and the child will be a little more satisfied if instead of being forced to stay. So like that, around the point of concentration, we can create a circle. Okay, if the mind can't focus on the holy name, let it have some other spiritual object, some devotional object to focus on. So if I have a beautiful picture of Krishna's deities, and I look at the picture, and then I think, oh, this is the same Krishna I'm addressing with the holy name. And we think like that, then we will feel more inspired to again focus on the holy name. Oh, this is Krishna I'm calling. So this is through the circle of concentration, because that is something which we are attracted. Oh, this picture of Krishna is so beautiful. It's so nice. This is the same Lord I'm worshipping. So again, we can become connected with Krishna. And this can also be some verse glorifying the holy name, which we maybe have it written in front of us or keep it in a small diary. Basically, the idea is, if the mind is going to be distracted, let there be a devotional distraction rather than a non-devotional or an anti-devotional distraction. And that devotional distraction, also we have to observe. Sometimes the devotional distraction may distract us more. So if that is happening, then that is pratikul, that is unfavorable to our bhakti. So we should avoid that. But if something is favorable, then we can adopt that. And the third is that actually we need to cultivate a more personal understanding of Krishna, a personal conception of Krishna. That means, say, if I call out to someone, say if I have a friend whose name is whatever, I say, I have a friend name is Naveen. Then I call out Naveen, I don't just utter the sound. As soon as I utter the name Naveen, what happens? The person comes to my mind. No, I think about the person, how he looks, how he talks, how he does this, how he does that, whatever it is. All those thoughts come to my mind. Why? Because I associate that sound with a person. Now, if say there is some name in some language which I don't understand, and the name itself is very difficult to pronounce, and then I may pronounce the name, but it will not awaken any emotion within me. It will not activate any thoughts within me. Why? Because I have not associated that name with a person. For me, it's just a noun. For me, it's some words that are being uttered. So actually, the more we read about Krishna, the more we hear about Krishna, the more we immerse ourselves in a personal understanding of Krishna, the more when we call out Krishna's name, the spiritual thoughts and spiritual desires will naturally become activated. That's why, you know, sometimes somebody goes to say, we should just chant 64 rounds. That's good if we can. But the point is not to chant 64 rounds. The point is to absorb ourselves in Krishna. Sometimes if we want, it's Ekadashi, it's a holy day, I want to chant 64 rounds. It's very good if we can. But what we should see is how much am I absorbing myself. Sometimes it might work out better that instead of chanting 64 rounds, I may chant 48 rounds, and 1.5 hours I spend in reading about Krishna. And if I read something about Krishna, then my thoughts will be more Krishnaized. So the idea is, we don't see chanting as just one activity. We see chanting as a means of developing a relationship with Krishna. And when we see it that way, when we have a more personal understanding of Krishna, now we will not let ourselves become distracted so much. Even if the distraction comes, that personal understanding will help us to resist the distraction. Now suppose if there's a family, the husband is working somewhere, in some other place. And then the husband comes back to meet the family, and then husband and wife are there. And the husband tells the wife, you know, okay, whenever I'm away, I think of you. But when the wife starts talking and the husband starts looking at the phone messages, then the wife will say, see, you know, when you are in front of me, you are not even paying attention to me. How can I believe that when I'm not in front of you, you're thinking about me? Isn't it? So like that, if we understand that Krishna is a person, then we are told to think about Krishna constantly. But when Krishna is manifesting as the holy name, if I'm not thinking about Krishna, then how can I think about him at other times? So actually, the more we get a personal understanding, the more we will become inspired to focus on Krishna. That's why hearing about Krishna is, hearing about Krishna, reading about Krishna, and especially reading about Krishna and hearing about Krishna in those pastimes in which we feel touched by Krishna's personal reciprocation with his devotees. That is important. And sometimes it may be just one pastime which you feel very touched, very inspired by how Krishna reciprocates. And then reading that pastime again, maybe hearing it from different devotees, maybe reading Sanskrit, memorizing some of those verses. Basically, we try to learn to approach Krishna more and more as a person. And then the more we approach him as a person, then naturally the association between the sound of the holy name and the person Krishna, that will become more and more implicit. So in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's case, for him, Krishna's holy name and Krishna are one and the same. And that's why he starts with the holy name and he ends with Krishna. There's a seamless transformation over there. Actually, it's not a transformation. It's just a manifestation that happens. And whatever it is, that whichever pastimes of Krishna, they help us to see him and approach him as a person. We can cherish those pastimes. Actually, the whole process of bhakti is a process of making our memory our treasury. Now, we want to make our memory our treasury. That means, now we want to have such sweet, relishable memories about Krishna within us, that wherever we are, they are a treasure we go back to, and we cherish and relish that treasure. So we all have certain memories within us, and we treasure those memories. Maybe some happy moments we may have had with our friends, family members, they're all good. At the same time, we also have had joyful moments, moments of intense spiritual experiences in our bhakti practices also. They may be intermittent, but we have had them. So we need to cultivate them, cherish them. So when we hear some leela of Krishna, we feel very deeply moved by it. Then we go revisit that. Okay, what was it that moved me so much? Maybe write it down in a journal. Our special spiritual experiences that we may have had, we can write them down in a journal. Because later on when we feel down, can go back. Oh, actually, you know, I have also tasted special bliss in bhakti. I may not be tasting it right now, but I have experienced something special in bhakti. And that can re-energize us. So, with respect to our worldly memories, the mind goes back very easily to those memories. But that's because our consciousness is inclined towards materialism right now. Like the, say the floor is inclined like this. And if I spill water over here, water will naturally go this way. So like that, our consciousness is inclined towards materialism right now. And that's why whenever we have any memories of worldly enjoyment, they become glued in the consciousness and they come back very quickly. On the other hand, spiritual memories, devotional memories don't come back so quickly. But we need to cultivate them. And when we cultivate them, when those leelas of Krishna which we connect with very nicely, we consciously revisit them, maybe memorize some aspects of those and meditate on them, then we'll be able to call out to Krishna as a person. And when we call out to Krishna as a person, then Krishna will reciprocate and Krishna will manifest in our heart, and then we'll realize that actually Krishna in his manifestation as the holy name is everything. If I have Krishna, I don't need anything else. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that, actually, he says, in this world, the holy name of Krishna is the only reality. In all the 14 worlds, there is no reality other than the holy name. That is a realization which we don't have right now. But the more we approach him, Krishna as a person, the more that realization will come. And when that happens, it is not that we neglect or reject the world, but rather, we learn to focus on Krishna even while we are acting in this world. We go through life, but we focus on Krishna. The more we are focused on Krishna, the less we are troubled by the ups and downs of life. Because we are conscious of a far bigger reality. And thus, a devotee moves onward through life, facing whatever ups and downs are there, but being absorbed in Krishna and satisfied and joyful in Krishna. So I'll summarize. I started by talking about when the topic was the holy name is everything. So I discussed that when we focus on the holy name, it is not that we are saying that just uttering some sound is everything. No, the holy name is not different from Krishna, and Krishna is the ultimate reality. So we discussed about Maya as illusion in perception, like a mirage, and Maya as illusion in conception. That means we see things disconnected from Krishna. So, Ah Brahma Samma Paryantam, when I discussed that verse, the Brahma is real, a blade of grass is real. But to think that these differences, whether I have a big position or a small position, these differences will make any ultimate difference. To think like that is an illusion, because they all are temporary. So don't let the temporary distract you from the eternal. That's the thrust of this verse. Krishna is the only eternal reality. And then while learning to focus on the holy name, we discuss three levels. Becoming conscious of our consciousness. In that we discussed about how we could say that the mind is like the screen, TV screen, which we as conscious beings are watching. And somebody just comes and flips the TV screen, changes the camera, changes what is being broadcast. And we don't even realize it. Or like we're watching a TV and a thief comes and steals away the TV. And we just keep watching the TV and don't realize that a theft is happening. So like that, you know, we get caught in one thing and then we lose track of other things. And that way, your mind takes us from this thing to that thing, and we get distracted and we don't even realize that we are distracted. So be conscious of our consciousness means at least become aware of what I am thinking. So just like if there's a door where there's light, then I can see who is coming in and who is going out. Like that, when we come to the mode of goodness, the door of our consciousness becomes illumined. And we can decide, this is a thought I want to focus on, this is a thought I won't focus on. So after we become conscious of our consciousness, then we become conscious of our distractions. Okay, where is my thoughts going? So we discussed two broad patterns, anxieties and desires, pleasures we could say. So with respect to anxieties, anxiety is like paying interest on a loan that we have not taken. It's a problem. Most of the things we worry about, they are not happened and they are not even likely to happen. So if we are worrying about something, it's good to use our intelligence to address those worries. You know, differentiate between possibilities and probabilities. We can't waste our life worrying about possibilities. With respect to probabilities, we can make out, okay, make a plan. This is what I have done, this is what I am going to do, and this is what I will leave to Krishna. Just because things are not in control does not mean that they are out of control. They are in Krishna's control. So the same thing that causes anxiety can also yield intensity. If I focus on that which is not in my control, I will get anxiety. But if I focus on what is in my control, it will give intensity. So when we are worried about something, if you remember that Krishna is in control, let me try to please and the servant please that Krishna by chanting now. Then that same anxiety can inspire us to focus more on the holy name also. Then with respect to pleasures and the distractors, talked about how our attachments are our unexamined definitions of pleasure. So when the mind gets excited about certain things, hey, come on, do this, do that, then we need to use our intelligence to examine, is this really worth getting excited about? I discussed about how this boy was so excited about going for a rock show, but then if it's just noise. So like that, we also have experiences, we get excited about something and when we do it, it's not all that great. So if we note down these experiences and we use the philosophy, of bhakti, what we have heard, what we have read and what we have experienced, to deflate the mind's imagination about pleasure, then we won't get so excited or distracted by the promises of pleasure which the mind dangles in front of us. And then we discuss about, after we become conscious of our consciousness and we become conscious of our distractions, then we become conscious of Krishna. In that I discuss three levels. First is using our intelligence. It's like a mother, she makes sure that her child takes the medicine. So our mind is like the child and the holy name of Krishna is like the medicine. So our intelligence has to become like a mother. And when we're taking a medicine, we don't focus on the taste, we focus on the effect. So even if the holy name doesn't taste good, let me take this as a medicine. And the second level is that when we are trying to focus on the holy name, there is the point of concentration and there is the circle of concentration. So even if I can't concentrate on Krishna's sound, holy name directly, let me create some devotional stimuli or let me find out what devotional stimuli connects me with Krishna nicely. Maybe it can be the picture of the deities, maybe it can be the print of the Hare Krishna Mahamantra, maybe it can be some verses glorifying the holy name. And that way, when the mind wanders off, give it some room for wandering. Just like a mother may allow a child to play in a certain room. Like that, give it some devotional room for wandering and then it will come back to Krishna. And third is, we cultivate a more personal conception of Krishna. That is by especially hearing about Krishna and especially hearing about those pastimes in which we feel touched by how Krishna acts as a living, loving person. And then when we become conscious that actually I am calling a person over here, then naturally we will become more conscious when calling that person. And thus we can become absorbed in Krishna more and more. And as we become absorbed in him more and more, then he will become the supreme reality for us. And the reality of this world, it won't shake us so much because we are aware of a far bigger reality. Then we can march steadily through life's journey, being absorbed in Krishna. Thank you very much. It's very easy to speak on the holy name. So I hope that I'm not being a hypocrite because I also have a very distracted mind and I'm also struggling to focus on the holy name when I chant. But I'm also trying to use my buddhi to learn to focus on the holy name. So I seek your prayers so that I can also improve my chanting. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. So do we have time for questions? Yes, please.
Yeah, in most of the books, we hear about Krishna and we talk, and I have heard so many talks. We always talk about a bigger reality, right? We talk about bigger reality, Krishna and all. What is that envision of that bigger reality? Like, what we actually mean by a bigger reality?
Okay. So when we talk about Krishna or when you read spiritual books, they often talk about a bigger reality. So what is this bigger reality? Yeah, the Bhagavad Gita explains that reality exists at three levels. There is the physical reality, there is the mental reality, and there is the spiritual reality. So physical reality is largely what we can touch with our senses, see with our eyes, touch with our hands, like that. And most of modern science studies physical reality. But even the study of physical reality reveals that there is more to reality. For example, now scientists, when they studied the universe, they have found that for the universe to be expanding at the pace at which it is expanding, for the universe to exist as it exists, there has to be far more matter than what is presently visible in the universe. And that's why they say that something between 95% to 98% of the universe is made of dark matter. So that means, by looking at the visible world, scientists have postulated that there is something which is invisible, which exists. So just the study of visible physical reality can point us to some reality beyond physical reality. Now, what that reality is, to know that, we need an appropriate means. The science basically looks for material explanations for material phenomena. Science basically observes material phenomena and then tries to find material explanations for those phenomena. It does not look for anything non-material. It's like if I have a fishing net, and if that fishing net, if I go for fishing, but the fishing net has a hole of say 1 inch by 1 inch, then I may fish for one full year, but I will never catch a fish whose size is smaller than 1 inch. It will just slip out of that net. So like that, our senses and science, which is based largely on sensory perception, that casts a net at the world around us to catch knowledge about that world. But the net itself is made of matter, it's material. And that's why non-material reality slips out of the net of science. So the point I'm making here is two things, that the study of physical reality through science itself points to some invisible reality also. And second is, when we study science, we will be able to find only material things to it, because the methodology is such that I cannot see non-material things with it. The method itself is like that. Just like if I have a black and white camera, no matter how high the resolution of the camera, I cannot see color image with it. So like that, science looks for material things. That's why it can't find spiritual. So there is another method. There is the method of spirituality, prior centered on yoga, which can make us aware of spiritual reality. So the Bhagavad Gita 9.2 says that pratyaksha avagamam dharmyam susukham kartum avyayam. Pratyaksha avagamam. We can practically experience it by the practice of the process of bhakti yoga. So bhakti pareshanubhava virakti ramyatraja. Bhakti is the process. Para isha anubhav. Anubhav is experience. Para is transcendental. That means beyond matter, non-material. Isha is the controller, God. So bhakti is the process that gives us para isha anubhav. Bhakti is the process that gives us experience of the transcendental Lord, transcendental control. So this is the method. So when we chant the holy names of Krishna, when we practice the process of bhakti yoga, we may do it as just cultural practices, and that is fine. We'll get some purification, we'll get some punya by that, some piety by that. But if we do it as a process for accessing higher reality, then higher levels of consciousness will rise to higher levels, and things which were not perceivable earlier, they will become intelligible and perceivable gradually. So it's largely a matter of knowledge also. It's like, you know, if somebody is a stockbroker and they see on the computer screen a line going down, and say they have got that person has got an employee who is illiterate and they don't know anything, and this boss, he sees the line going down suddenly, and he gets a heart attack, and the assistant says, what happened? Mm-hmm. Just a line went down in the computer screen, why are you getting a heart attack? Mm-hmm. Why? Because it is actually our knowledge that transforms perception into comprehension. The perception is a line going down. But what does the line going down? It means the stock market has crashed. And, stock market has crashed means I lost my money. And that gives a heart attack. So for one who doesn't understand about what the graph means, there is no understanding. There is no effect of that. So like that, as we get spiritual knowledge more and more, then even from the material reality, we start understanding higher reality. And as we become purified, then the higher spiritual reality becomes evident to us. This higher spiritual reality has three aspects to it. There is Sat, Chit and Ananda. It's eternal, it's conscious and it is joyful. Just like say, if there is a, after today's program, say there is a Gulab Jamun. In the feast, there is a Gulab Jamun. So while we are sitting here, first the fragrance of the Gulab Jamun comes here. Oh, this is nice. Then we go to the kitchen and we see, oh, there's such nice round shaped, that's good looking balls are there over there. Spherical objects. And then we go and eat it. Ah, this is Samadhi. We get delighted. So, what has happened is, in the same Gulab Jamun, but first we perceive the smell, then we perceive perceive the sight, and then we perceive the taste. It's like closer and closer experience of that object. So like that, when we talk about the higher reality, the first thing we perceive is Sat. There is some eternal existence beyond the temporary existence of this world. Things are constantly changing. But underlying this changing, there has to be something which is unchanging. There has to be some unchanging reality at the foundation of the changing reality. Now, if I have a skyscraper building, if I am at the top, I can look down. It may seem to go down infinitely. But there has to be a ground somewhere. Otherwise, the skyscraper would not exist. So like that, everything we see is temporary. So if we just go back temporary, we cannot have an infinite chain of temporary things. There has to be something eternal from which the temporary has come. It's like a building has to have ground on it to be founded. So like that, by inference, we can understand there is something eternal. And then we see that there is consciousness. You are conscious, I am conscious. So consciousness is also a reality. So that eternal reality, that is not just existence, but it is also conscious. This is so first we understand that there is something eternal beyond this world. Then we understand that eternal reality is conscious. Then that means it's conscious means that the reality is observing us. We are accountable to that reality. That is the conception of God as a judge to whom I am accountable. But beyond that, we also understand that, you know, if a person has to do nothing except be a judge for all of life, that person will get bored, you know. That a judge also has their personal life, they have their family members, and that's where they enjoy loving relationships. So like that, we understand this absolute truth also has ananda. It reciprocates love and gets happiness in that. And that Satchitananda absolute truth, that is revealed in the yoga text, in the Bhagavad Gita and the yoga text, to be Krishna. So if I think of Krishna simply as some image that I see in a temple, I may think, what is this? But if you go through a chain of philosophical inference, then we understand that there is absolute truth beyond there is a bigger reality beyond this visible reality. And in that bigger reality, there is a manifestation of God as a living, loving person. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah.
So, like when people practice spirituality, some people observe that difficulties in their life has increased. Like
okay.
Problems in their life has increased. Or it could be the case that when there's more problem in life, people become spiritual. So, like, is it like some correlation to it, philosophical or in
our okay. Philosophy? Good question.
Can you repeat
this? Yeah, yeah. So, is it that some people when they start practicing bhakti, sometimes their problems seem to increase. And for others, when their problems increase, they start practicing bhakti more seriously. So is there any correlation between problems and the practice of bhakti? Actually, bhakti is ahaituki. Ahaituki means it does not have any material cause. So that means that it is not that just because something material happens, that's why I will practice bhakti. See, there are people who face problems, and when they face problems, I need to take shelter of God. Krishna talks about this category of people. when he says arto, he says four categories of people come to me, he says in 7.16, and one of them is the distressed. So trouble in our worldly life can inspire us to take shelter of Krishna. On the other hand, a trouble in our worldly life can also make us atheistic. Now, there are so many problems in life. Where is there? What is the idea of a good God? You know, well, God would never allow such things to happen. So the same event can cause us to move towards Krishna. It can cause us to move away from Krishna. So in that sense, problems themselves never generate bhakti. It is rather our response to the problems that decides whether we will practice bhakti or not. And this response is also determined not just by our choice. It's also determined by our culture, our surroundings. So sometimes when we are trying to share bhakti with some people and they are not interested. Now it is good to never part with anyone on an argumentative note. No, you are wrong and I am right. No, we try to argue. Even if they are not ready to practice bhakti right now, let them go with the impression that, okay, I made a nice person. I don't agree with everything that they say, but I made a nice person. Then eventually when they face some problems, then they will, yes, this person said this, it made sense. They will come to Krishna at that time. So if we can provide more and more access to bhakti through having temples, through having cordial contacts with people in our interactions with them, then when the problems come, they are more likely to come towards Krishna. If they are also having a pious culture, if they have been born about a pious culture, their parents, they have seen their parents, their grandparents, and they always, whenever they are troubled, they go to God to seek help, then they will also come to Krishna that way. So that's how, through their choice, through their culture, through their circumstance, we can actually make it easier for people to come to Krishna when they have problems. And also, if there is somebody whom we know in a devotee community, if they have problems, then we should actually assist them in whatever way we can, so that they can go over that problem. Now, is it possible that for some devotees, that after they start practicing bhakti, their problems increase? Now, that is possible, but it is not a causal connection. It is not that because we started practicing bhakti, the problems increased. Sometimes it may appear like that, because we start practicing bhakti and then maybe our friends, our relatives, they start becoming a little suspicious about us, little critical of us. But quite often this happens not because we are practicing bhakti, but it happens because we try to impose bhakti on them. That means when I start practicing bhakti, I say, hey, this is so wonderful, you know, everybody should be practicing it. And then what took us, maybe it took us 6 months to decide to start practicing bhakti, and we think that, you know, in 30 minutes I'll give a lecture and they'll start practicing bhakti. We try to download the whole philosophy of bhakti and the practices of bhakti in one dose. And people say, hey, this is too much. Then when people start feeling that we are imposing our practices on them, then they become more hostile. And then not only they don't accept it, but they want to pull us also away from it. So if we don't do that, it's not that practicing bhakti necessarily increases problems. So if we are ourselves sensitive, mature, I took time for deciding things, they will also take their time. Let me provide them aids in making decisions, but let me not impose. Then it's not necessary that the practice of bhakti will increase problems. Now it's possible sometimes that somebody comes to bhakti and problems increase in their life. That is simply, we all go through periods in our life. Just like there are cosmic seasons, sometimes it is hot, sometimes it is cold. So like that, based on our past karma, there are certain times in our life when things are going to be smooth. There are sometimes when things are going to be a little turbulent. And it may happen that the turbulent phase may coincide with the time when we start practicing bhakti. For some people it can happen like that. But it is not that bhakti has caused those problems. It is rather, if they take shelter of Krishna at that time, then they will realize that the same problems, if I did not have bhakti, I would have been so burdened by them. But now I am able to deal with them. So there was one devotee, one boy, and I was in Pune, I was going to one college. This boy became a very dynamic devotee, and he had a close friend. That friend, he tried to make him, also get him to practice bhakti. That friend was not practicing bhakti at all, keeping it at a distance. And then, after both of them passed out, now this boy who became a devotee, he had good marks in his exam, and he was expected to get a job in campus. But for almost 6-8 months after the after he got passed out, he did not get any job. And you know, he was worried about that. But it was during those 6-8 months, his friend observed that, you know, although he did not have a job, still he was not crippled by anxiety. And by seeing that, his friend became a devotee. So what happened in this case was, he observed that his friend, if he had not been practicing bhakti, he would have been depressed, he would have got into inferiority complex, so many things could have happened to him. But seeing that those things didn't happen, that brought him to bhakti. So the point I'm making here is that bhakti can enable us, problems may come in our life, but if we take shelter of Krishna, bhakti will enable us to deal with those problems better. So we shouldn't become fearful that if I start practicing bhakti, my problems will increase. No. What will increase by our practice of bhakti is our problem enduring capacity. Because we are taking shelter of Krishna. Now sometimes the problems may increase, but they are not increasing because of the practice of bhakti. They are increasing because of our destinies in a particular way, karmic reactions are playing out in a particular way. But whatever comes in our life, it is, by the grace of Krishna, we will be able to deal with it better. Whatever karma sends our way, Krishna will help us through it. So with that faith, we should just focus on the practice of bhakti and not worry about problems increasing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, Mandali.
I'd ever get to see you in person. And thank you for coming. So I have watched you for a number of years. So thank you for coming.
Happy to be of service, Mandy. Thank you.
Prabhuji, I was really interested when I came to know about you, because one of the issues, I was in Australia and then I came here. One of the issues that I have seen is that why there is conflict always between science and spirituality. Why can't we talk about integration, science and spirituality? And what was happening in, for example, at University of Melbourne also, a lot of people from science background, I'm an animal scientist, a lot of people from science background, they wanted to come and hear about spirituality. But the moment sometimes, this doesn't happen everywhere, but sometimes people straight away, especially in spiritual gatherings, they start talking about science. Some people will start about laughing about it. So a lot of people from science, they tend to stay away from that. Same way, when we go to a scientific conference, people, when we, for example, I talk to my friends, let's go and listen to the spiritual gathering. This is really good. And they start laughing. So why is always this? Why can't we have this integration? Because we know science and spirituality, both are doing great job, wonders for betterment of life and people.
Yeah.
Why can't they come together?
So why can't science and spirituality be integrated together? Why is it that spiritual people are critical of science? And why is it that scientific people often ridicule spirituality? Yeah. Actually, the conflict comes because we don't recognize the scopes of science and spirituality. So I'll start from science perspective, then I'll come to spiritual perspective. The science has transformed the world around us in the last 500 years. Even in the last 50 years, there's been remarkable transformation. And in that sense, there is no denying the power of science in terms of giving us a framework for dealing with matter. At the same time, science does not give us knowledge of reality. It gives us models of reality. There's a difference between reality and a model of reality. To explain this, this is a whole big subject. In fact, I have many seminars on science and spirituality, but I just keep it as simple as possible. That if we study, presently there are two main branches of physics. There is quantum physics and there is relativity. Now, according to relativity, there are particles which exist. According to quantum physics, there are no particles, there are only waves. Now, if you ask physicists, what is the reality? What is it actually? Are there waves or are there particles? Actually, these two theories, both of them work. Quantum physics works in certain fields. Relativity works in certain fields. But in terms of their conceptual understanding of what is the reality, both of them are contradictory. Violently contradictory. So, what is the nature of reality? Most physicists today, they say we don't talk about the nature of reality. There are many books written on the history of science. One well-known book is, it talks about how science evolved in the 20th century by a science journalist David Peake. The title of that book is From Certainty to Uncertainty. So basically, science gives us very powerful models of reality. Quantum physics works as one model of reality. Relativity works as another model of reality. But the two, they don't match. And there's no one known who knows how to match them also. And it's not just, it's a deep subject, but the point simply is that science doesn't give us reality. It gives us models of reality. And the models of reality are useful, very useful. But they don't describe reality totally. Unfortunately, there are atheists who take science and there is a prestige associated with science and they misappropriate it for propagating atheism. They start saying that, you know, if you are scientific, how can you believe in this religious mythology? How can you believe in soul? How can you believe in God? How can you believe in all this stuff? Now, actually speaking, science, as I explained earlier, it observes material phenomena and gives material explanations for material phenomena. Science does not talk anything about non-material reality. Whether it exists or not, if it exists, how it can be accessed, science doesn't talk about that. So when atheists use science to propagate atheism, they are actually extending science beyond its valid jurisdiction. Science has its power in giving us knowledge of things as they exist. But science doesn't answer ultimate questions. You know, Albert Einstein said that we can talk about the ethical foundations of science, but we cannot turn around and talk about the scientific foundation of ethics. What is right and wrong? How do I decide that? The science can tell me that if I have a grandmother who has given her inheritance to me, that if I put arsenic in her breakfast, I can get the inheritance tomorrow. I'm not saying scientists will do that. Scientists will do that or scientifically minded people will do that. All that I'm saying is, science can tell me that this is going to happen. If arsenic goes into a person's bloodstream, they will die. But whether that is right or wrong, science doesn't tell us that. The science by itself is not moral or immoral. It is amoral. Amoral means it does not deal with issues of morality. So, moral decisions, what is right, what is wrong, that we get to know from some other source. Science doesn't tell us that. And it's not a deficiency of science to not be able to tell us that. Because science is a particular way of acquiring knowledge. So, when atheists in the garb of science, atheists using the prestige of science, ridicule spirituality, then they are actually extending science beyond its valid jurisdiction. So there can be scientists who can be atheists, there can be scientists who can be theists, there can be scientists who can be agnostics. But this is coming from their own experience, this is coming from their own intellectual analysis. This is not a necessary conclusion of science. So science is neutral with respect to God. From scientific findings, people who have faith in God, they can see science as a way of increasing their faith in God. There are atheists who can think, oh, science answers all questions. And they can use science to boost up their atheism. Science is simply a tool for acquiring knowledge in a particular way of a particular aspect of reality. But when it is misappropriated for promoting particular ideologies, when say it is used for propagating, it is misappropriated for propagating atheism, then scientists ridicule spirituality. That's one aspect to it. Now with respect to spiritualists, when they criticize science, yeah, actually what Srila Prabhupada was sometimes quite strong in his criticism of science. But if you look at it carefully, he was critical, you know, in this one morning conversation where Srila Prabhupada says that, you know, we are not against the knowing spirit of science. I mean, scientists want to know, we are not against that. We are against their atheism. That means, ideally speaking, the spiritual is, they recognize that spirituality is a different body of knowledge. And when science starts making statements about spirituality, then that, when scientists start making it appear as if to be scientific, you have to be atheistic. When science starts propagating atheism, then spiritualists criticize that. But the criticism is not of science. It is actually about the invalid extrapolation of science beyond its jurisdiction. So, the way I see the two coming together is that science can make things better, spirituality can make people better. Now, with science, we can make many gadgets better. We can have better communication technology, we can have better transformation technology. It can make things better. But science itself does not provide us methodology by which we can make people better. No, science cannot. That if some people have, say, some people have greed, some people have excessive lust, some people have excessive anger. And if a person has too much anger, there is no pill that science can give. Take this pill and your anger will go away. They can give pills by which we can put people to sleep. But we cannot cure anger. So, there are undesirable, unhealthy forces within us which make us act in ways that are destructive for others and damaging for ourselves also. And those cannot be countered by science. But spirituality offers us methods for doing that. So when we practice yoga, when we practice meditation, then we connect with our spiritual core. We experience higher wisdom and higher satisfaction within ourselves. And then that enables us to combat the lower forces that are there within us. And this is something that millions of people all over the world, for example, those who practice bhakti yoga, millions of people all over the world have experienced this. They have had some unhealthy habits and they're struggling to give it up. But once they start practicing bhakti yoga, those habits fall away. Now, it is not that this will happen for everyone. It is, why it will not happen? Because some people may not actually be practicing bhakti as a serious spiritual discipline. They may just be doing it as a ritual. Okay, my culture tells me to do it, so I'll do it. So it's possible that even among people who are religious, people who claim to be spiritual, there may be people who sometimes behave badly, sometimes they also act immorally, and they may do wrong things. That happens because they are not practicing spirituality as a process for self-transformation. They are simply practicing spirituality as a cultural practice or as a socially respectable facade. Now, if I am in a particular society where it looks nice if I go to church, if I go to mosque, if I go to temple, that's why I go there. But then I stay materialistic and I just want to put on a facade. So that can also happen. So just like a person who goes to a hospital but doesn't take the medicine, they're going to stay sick. You know, if a person was sick and they go to a hospital not to take medicine, but you know, for some other purpose. So like that, some people may come to the process of spirituality also, come to spiritual places, but they're not really interested in spiritual transformation. So then they will not be transformed. That's why if we meet spiritualists who are serious about growing spiritually, then they will help us understand how science and spirituality can be integrated together. And when people come with ulterior agendas, then it is atheists who come to science to misappropriate science, they will criticize spirituality. And when spiritualists come for some purpose other than spiritual growth, then they may also end up criticizing science because for them, they are not really interested in spiritual growth. So that's why if we meet people who are serious practitioners of spirituality, they can guide us about how the two can be integrated. Does that answer your question?
Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna. Should stop here?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, do we have time? Or should
I broke the mic.
You can spare the mic. Switch off that mic and try this mic.
Okay, you can tell the question.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
Yeah,
good. This is the last question.
Science, the real knowledge of it, can we live without science?
Okay. Does science offer real knowledge? Can we live without science in this age? Okay, as I said, science offers us models of reality. And whether it offers us reality, that is a complex question which even many scientists don't bother to address. Because what is reality? We have got multiple models, working models, and we don't know what is what. So, to give a simple example of this, if I have a map of America, I can have a political map, I can have a topographical map, you know, I can have a map in terms of, say, the existence of minerals under the earth. So now, all these maps will be looking at the same territory, but I may see them as significantly different, and substantially different. So, if I don't know that all of them are maps of America only, I may think, oh, this is showing something different, this is showing something different, this is showing something different. Now, all those maps are useful, but no map describes the territory exhaustively. So, science offers us a map of reality. And in today's world, this map is not only useful, for many purposes, it is indispensable. Especially if you are living in the modern postmodern civilization. We are surrounded by technology, and technology is a product of science mapping of the world. So there can be alternative ways of looking at the world also. So to give an example, allopathy maps the human body in a particular way. Ayurveda maps the human body in another way. In Ayurveda, there is the concept of kapha, vata, pitta. Now they consider the digestive fire, jatharagni, as the primary parameter of health. So if the digestive fire is strong, then the person will be healthy. Now, if we ask from an allopathic perspective, we'll say, what do you mean by fire? The body has temperature that is created by metabolism, but there's no such thing as a fire in the body. So now, actually speaking, if we see, allopathy works in curing patients, Ayurveda also works in curing patients. So now there may be some allopaths who may mock at Ayurveda. There may be some Ayurvedic doctors who may mock at allopathy. But the fact is both work in different situations for different people. So just as these two are models of the same human body. And there may be some things which match, there may be some things which don't match. So whichever model works for a person, they can use that. So like that, we as devotees don't have to go on a crusade against science or a crusade for science. Science is a tool for acquiring knowledge, and in many ways it gives useful knowledge, and in today's socio-cultural context is the science products are indispensable everywhere. But the model which science offers us looking at reality, that is not the only model. It's a whole different way of looking at reality also. And some of the Vedic scriptures, for example, Sankhya that is described in the third canto, is very briefly described. But that offers us a different way of looking of matter. It is looking at matter, but matter as composed of elements, fundamental elements, and as manifestations of the energy of God. It's a different way of looking of matter. So that's also another way of looking of matter. And Prabhupada encouraged devotees to do research in that way and explain that. That's also good. So science gives us knowledge, definitely. It's valid knowledge, but it is not exhaustive knowledge. The scientific picture of reality is correct, but it is not complete. It is correct when we consider it in terms of the model that it is offering. See, if science were not correct, now when I call you, if you are in India, I'm in America, I call you, my call is reaching you. So certainly there is some significant level of correctness that is there in science way of looking at knowledge, looking at the world. But it is not exhaustive. And when it is made, we consider it to be exhaustive, that's where it becomes wrong. So, I'll conclude with a simple example. Suppose somebody is playing a billiards game. Now, say somebody hits a ball, and say with a stick they hit a ball, and this ball hits another group of balls, and then one ball goes into the hole. Now, if I look at it only from the framework of the table, if I am looking from just above the table, and how did this ball go into the hole? I can explain that in terms of the laws of physics. Now, this stick was moved at this force, and it imparted, it hit this ball at this angle, and the whole, it's complex, but we can describe it in terms of the laws of physics, how the force with which the stick was moved, that caused the ball to go into the hole. That is a valid explanation. Now, if I extend my frame a little bigger, further, I can say, oh, there's an expert billiards player who was playing, and it was because of the expertise of that billiards player that the ball went into the hole. The two explanations that the ball went into the hole because of the force with which it was hit and the angle it was at which it was hit, explanation in terms of the laws of physics, and explanation by looking at the expertise of the player. Both these explanations, they are not contradictory. They are complementary. So like that, science offers us explanation of things from a finite framework, from a particular framework. And within that framework, it is valid. But if it is made into an exhaustive description of all of reality, then it becomes incorrect. So it is correct, but it is not complete. When the incomplete is thought of as complete, then it becomes incorrect. Okay. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Another program, if you want to hear more,